Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia this week received widespread media attention, but most of the coverage focused on the strained relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. There wasn't much coverage of U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia as it continues its deadly air attacks in Yemen, or calls to declassify top-secret 9/11 documents. Former Senator Bob Graham says 28 pages of top-secret documents reveal that the Saudi government supported and funded the 9/11 attacks. He was on 60 Minutes just a few weekends ago. And the New York Times is reporting that Saudi Arabia has told the Obama administration and members of Congress that it will sell off hundreds of billions of dollars worth of American assets held by the kingdom if Congress passes a bill that would allow the Saudi government to be held responsible in American courts for any role in the attacks. So today we are talking about what drives coverage of Saudi Arabia in the United States. Craig Unger is an investigative journalist and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. He is the author of the best-selling book, House of Bush, House of Saud, which reveals the complex relationship between Bush family political circles and elite Saudi families and the influence of that relationship on American foreign policy during both Bush administrations. And Craig joins us from New York. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. And later in the show, we will be discussing media coverage of voter disenfranchisement during New York's primary. Hillary Clinton won the primary with 58% of the vote to Bernie Sanders' 42%. The Nation's Ari Berman reports that just under 20% of eligible New Yorkers cast a ballot. That's because the Kings County Board of Elections purged 126,000 registered Democrats from the voting rolls in Brooklyn, and 3 million New Yorkers did not get to vote because they were not registered with the Democratic or Republican parties. And we will talk about that and also give you information about what you need to do if you want to vote in the presidential primary on June 7th here in California. We do not want to see this happen in California. So, Craig, let's start off with you as we always do on our media roundtable. We start off on a positive note and highlight really good journalism this week. So what stood out for you this week?
Well, you know, I think a blog that very few people read that I found consistently good on the Middle East is by Jim Loeb, L-O-B-E, and he has a blog called Loeb Blog, and it's on foreign policy, largely on the Middle East, and he's just someone I trust a lot. He's recently had interviews with the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Charles Freeman, who was ambassador under George H.W. Bush and is actually one of the more candid people who gives a real sense of history about what's going on in the Middle East.
And what do you think, what stands out on this site from Jim Loeb compared to, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post?
Well, it's very different. And for one is he's been a consistent critic of neoconservatives. And, you know, as you mentioned, I wrote the book House of Bush, House of Saud. And what I and subsequent books, and what I found again and again was how neocons have influenced American policy, how they drove us into war with Iraq, how they falsified intelligence, and this site has always kept monitored that narrative very closely. What you see in it, if you read it regularly, is there are warring narratives, and the neocons have always tried to exaggerate the threat of first Saddam Hussein now and then Iran for many, many years and have been responsible for a lot of the conflict in the Middle East.
And so this is Loeblog, L-O-B-E, log.com. Just to give you some ideas of what they write about, there's stories, Hillary the Hawk, Inside the Devastation of America's Drone Wars, Saudi Arabia and Obama, Time to Reset Relations. So let's dive in and talk about President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia. This week, he attended the GCC summit, which includes Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman. And this is President Obama's fourth trip to Saudi Arabia. Much of the coverage this time around, Craig, focused on how President Obama tried to mend relations with Saudi Arabia, which have become more contentious, especially around the Iran deal. Why did he go to Saudi Arabia on Wednesday?
Well, I think he's got a very, very difficult balancing act, because the United States is not going to abandon its relationship with Saudi Arabia, but it's changed enormously, and the ties have weakened again and again and again over the last 15 years. So much has changed. One is we're not as energy dependent as we were. We're within 3 years or so of becoming a net exporter of oil, so we're not exactly as it used to be for over 35 years since the 1979 Iran revolution. The only protector of oil Western oil interests in the Persian Gulf was Saudi Arabia. And now that we've opened the doors to Iran with the Iran nuclear deal, it looks like we're edging back closer towards having a rapprochement, perhaps, with Iran. That hasn't happened quite yet, but we're not nearly as dependent on Saudi Arabia. And I think it's important to understand that probably the central dynamic in the Middle East today is an ongoing Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia for hegemony in the Middle East. And the Saudis have not had a place at the table. We have shut them out for 35 years, and now we've opened the door at least a crack. And the Saudis hate that. They're very much against it. It threatens them a lot. Other than oil, what does Saudi Arabia have going for it? Well, it's got hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons that we've sold them. Mm-hmm. But they want to keep their influence in the Middle East.
And Craig, what really drives U.S. coverage of Saudi Arabia? I mean, you wrote an entire book about the Saudi relationship with the Bush family. And I'm thinking about Beats, because in order to really understand this relationship, you have to spend a lot of time exploring it. So are there reporters in the United States that are specifically covering the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Well, that's one reason I mentioned Loblaw, because I found him to be consistently reliable, but that is not the case in if you look at the American media as a whole. And from my point of view, the neocons had much, much too much influence on our coverage. And the Saudis were also brilliant at public relations. And especially if you go back to the era of the elder George Bush, he and Prince Bandar were very, very close friends, personal friends, really, that went on hunting trips together. Bandar would drop by without an invitation to Kennebunkport, to the summer residence of the presidents. And coverage kind of reflected that close relationship. And what it didn't see is here we are, best friends with a theocratic monarchy, and the state religion they are sworn to defend is Wahhabi Islam, and in its most pernicious form, it gave birth to Osama bin Laden, to Al-Qaeda, and now a generation later after the Iraq War, it plays a role in ISIS, and the Saudis have played a role in funding that, a very big role.
Well, and there's so much to discuss this week because of the trip, but also the weapons that the U.S. is selling Saudi Arabia. Senator Bob Graham on 60 Minutes recently talking about the 28-page documents that he says reveals Saudi Arabia funded the 9/11 attacks, families calling to sue Saudi Arabia. So first, let's talk about the weapons. So last year, the United States approved the sale of $1.3 billion in weapons to Saudi Arabia. According to the United Nations, Saudi-led air attacks in Yemen have killed 6,000 Yemeni civilians. In February, Amnesty International called for governments around the world to, quote, set their hypocrisy aside and stop selling billions of dollars worth of deadly weapons to Saudi Arabia being used to attack Yemeni civilians, end quote. We noticed that this wasn't getting that much attention this week, Craig.
Right. Well, you know, as I say, the Saudis have been brilliant at engineering PR, and I think in a lot of ways the dynamics of the situation are so confusing people can't figure out what side everyone is on. Because if you look at Yemen, again, is a proxy war between Iran and the Saudis. And the Saudis want to destroy the Iranian-backed Houthis. And you have As a result, they're killing many, many civilians, as you say. But they're effectively allied with ISIS. And so inadvertently, we are backing ISIS. And you see the same thing in Syria. To the extent we've tried to topple Assad, and Assad, that effectively we are then inadvertently aiding ISIS. So we're sort of caught in this position where it's very difficult to have a coherent policy.
When you read that since last March, the Obama administration has approved the sale of $20 billion in weapons to Saudi Arabia. As a journalist, how do you get the details of that? I mean, who is actually making these weapons, and how is the money exchanging hands? I always wonder that because it's never in any articles.
Right. You know, I'm not sure I can, I'm good, have much to offer on that. But, you know, this has been going on since 1981, and it was considered a great scandal, or at least a major issue in 1981. And this comes just after the Iranian Revolution. So we no longer had that Iranian ally. And Prince Bandar was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, and he started meeting with then newly elected Vice President George H.W. Bush, and suddenly we were selling billions and billions every year to Saudi Arabia, and we have for the last 15 years. But I think what's new in all of this is people are starting to become aware of the Saudi role in terrorism. Hmm. That is, if you look at almost every major really violent attack, the World Trade Center, more recently the attacks in Belgium at Charlie Hebdo, at Bataclan in Paris, earlier the attacks in Tanzania in the late 90s, and Kenya, all of those were either Al-Qaeda or ISIS-inspired, and largely were an outgrowth of Saudi influence.
And you wrote about all of that in a recent piece for the Huffington Post. So why do you think Saudi Arabia doesn't get more scrutiny in the U.S. media?
Well, that's a good question. I think they've just had a very powerful PR operation. I think there actually is more response now than there was back then. And the mask is being lifted off the Saudis to some extent, and that's one reason why you see someone like Senator Graham start to get traction on this, on the 28 pages. That was an issue back when I wrote House of Bush 12 years ago, and I talked to Senator Graham back then. He knew a lot about it, and he's been very consistent for the last 12 years or whatever it is, and he's been pressing forward. But the United States, you know, has not buckled down. Also, a new factor that's a changing dynamic is that the Saudis have effectively become allied with Israel. And I was in Iran recently, and all the Iranians I talked to just took it as a matter of course that the Saudis were closely allied with Israel. If you go back 15 years, that wasn't the case at all. And back in, I believe it was just 2000 or just before 9/11, you had then Crown Prince Abdullah, who just berated President George W. Bush because he was not playing an active role on behalf of the Palestinians in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And back then, it seemed as if the Saudis were very much in the camp of the Palestinians. Today, it seems as if they've abandoned them entirely and are almost entirely allied with Israel.
Craig Unger is an investigative journalist, contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and author of the best-selling book House of Bush, House of Saud, which reveals the relationship between Bush family political circles and elite Saudi families. And we're talking about media coverage of Saudi Arabia and the United States. President Obama was in Saudi Arabia this week, and there are so many angles to this story, in addition to the strained relationship, which got most of the attention in the media. But what about the weapons sales? What about former Senator Bob Graham appearing on 60 Minutes on April 10th talking about the declassification of 28 top secret 9/11 report pages. Did you see that piece? Have you heard about this story? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What really stands out for you about what you read about Saudi Arabia or what you don't read in the media? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Craig, for people who have not been following this, tell us a little more about the 28 pages that former Senator Bob Graham is calling to declassify. He's calling the Obama administration to declassify. And it's not just Bob Graham. Nancy Pelosi is also now on board. And Bob Graham chaired the inquiry that wrote the pages. He said, quote, "The pages primarily relate to who financed 9/11, and they point a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia as being the principal financier," end quote. So tell us about those 28 pages.
Right. Well, I have not seen the pages precisely because they are classified. I did talk to Senator Graham about it way back around 2003 or 2004, and he's been very, very consistent in trying to get to the bottom of it. You know, it's interesting to me because even when I wrote my book, there was a fair amount of evidence that the Saudi royal family did support not just terrorism, but the actual 9/11 hijackers in a personal way. And there were reports, for example, and I reported some of this, that Prince Bandar's wife, Princess Haifa, had given a substantial sums that made its way to one charity, then to another charity, and they ended up in the hands of the hijackers who actually did 9/11. And the Saudis have a rather complicated system, which sounds almost benign at first. They're, my God, they're giving to charity. But it ends up going to Al-Qaeda in the end, or to terrorists, and it's continued to this day. And though I don't know specifically what is in those 28 pages, I suspect it's more of the same. And we had, you know, it's interesting. We had a fair amount of evidence even back then that the Saudis played a role. We knew that 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals. We knew about Osama bin Laden. We had some specific evidence on transfers to charities that went to other charities that backed terrorism. And what's striking to me is none of this is new, but it's finally getting some attention. And I, of course, would very much love to see those 28 pages come out in the open.
Well, there's a website called 28pages.org, and it's basically a hub for the movement to declassify these pages. And they quote a Kentucky Representative Thomas Massey, who was escorted to a soundproof room to read the redacted section and these 28 pages. He said it was a shocking experience. Quote, "I had to stop every couple pages and try to rearrange my understanding of history. It challenges you to rethink everything," end quote. Now, Craig, when you read about this, I mean, so much of our foreign policy is done in the name of 9/11. So why isn't this getting more attention?
Well, you know, I think there's always been in the throughout the entire Middle East, even predating 9/11, an incredible chasm between reality and rhetoric. And I was in Iran last year, for example, and you know the harsh rhetoric they have for Israel, that we must wipe off the face of the map the Zionist state, and we're the great Satan, and we call, as Sheldon Adelson has called, for nuking Iran. So on the surface, it's just incredible hatred. And yet when I look back through it, even throughout the entire 1980s, it turned out that Iran was getting about 80% of its weapons from Israel, its putative enemy. So there was, under the surface, a completely different relationship. And I think you see this with the Saudis today and so forth. And when I talked about Israel and Saudi having a strategic alliance, I meant it quite seriously. And that's one of the things that tends to mitigate against Washington and the press being really tough on Saudi Arabia. And so you have a lot of conflicting forces that are, and a lot of them are not what they appear to be on the surface.
We have a couple of calls on this. Let's go to Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Morning. Really good to talk to you, Rose. And, you know, I've been saying that for many years. Many, many, many years. Saudi Arabia is the most despicable country on earth. And, you know, don't forget, why did they have Saudis lefted right in the morning of 9/11? What did somebody know? And how come we never were told? Saudi Arabia played a bad role in the Middle East, not only recently, but they did everything they can to break Nasser, who was a very good man, who did everything to unite the Arabs and to did awful thing for Egypt and the whole Arab world. So I agree with you, just totally. And I'd also like to commend him for bringing the name of the neocons. The neocons have played awful role from the Iraq war to what's happening in Syria today to what happened in Libya to what actually even happened in Ukraine, Georgia a few years ago. Mm-hmm. They want just to ignite Third World War for what? I don't know. And please, everybody, Hillary Clinton is nothing but an agent for those guys.
Well, thank you for calling. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go first to Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Hi. The fact that the Bush family and the Bush administration were so closely allied with Saudi Arabia, you know, in a very personal basis, means that the fact that most of the 9/11 people in the plane were Saudis, and the fact that the Saudis helped finance it, is just one more indication that 9/11 was conceived by the Bush administration. You can't not talk about that anymore. And it's obviously an inside job. Anybody who doesn't think so hasn't looked at the videos of Building 7 falling down, where it clearly falls down from the bottom, not the official theory that it, you know, pancaked from the top. So if you look at those videos, and there's lots of them, you can, you know, just Google it, on the Building 7 video, you know that it's an inside job. And if you look at the Saudis' contribution to it, you know, both in personnel and in money, you know that it was, you know, the American administration plus the Saudis who were doing it.
Well, thank you for calling, Lawrence. So Craig, when it comes to really getting to the truth about what happened, can you talk about that aspect of this? Bob Graham going on 60 Minutes has now raised a lot of questions about what really happened.
Right. By the way, I should say I don't agree with the last caller about it being completely an inside job in the way he was talking about. I think it's more a case of being so close that the Bushes turned a blind eye to what Saudi Arabia was really about, and that there was so much at stake in this Saudi relationship. Let's remember the Persian Gulf. You know, is the more oil goes through the Straits of Hormuz, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but it is the lifeblood of the West, of Western Europe, and now and to the United States, and has been since World War II. So the United States, under no president, would permit us to, Democrat or Republican, would ever permit us to lose control of Persian Gulf oil. And it comes to a very narrow path there, the Straits of Hormuz, and this is sort of one of those trigger points in history that could touch off a massive, massive war. Mm. And the two key powers there are Iran and the Saudis. So once the Iranian Revolution took place in 1979, our only ally left was Saudi Arabia, and that's why that Saudi relationship was so crucial. With 9/11, we finally began to see the really dark side of it, that Wahhabi Islam, I think, is probably the most pernicious factor in fueling terrorism of the kind we've seen, and inadvertently we have allied with it because the Saudis were there to protect the Persian Gulf for us.
Craig Unger is an investigative journalist, author of the book House of Bush, House of Saud. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. And if the elevator tries to break you down, go crazy, punch a higher floor.
invite you to join today's conversation on Your Call, the weekly media roundtable. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can send your email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, Inflection Point, and at noon today, the Tavis Smiley Show.
Well, it's appropriate that on Monday we are going to do a show about Bay Area Dance Week and the benefits of dancing so we can play some more incredible Prince songs on Monday. I hope you can join us for that. Today it is our media roundtable, and I want to thank Craig Unger for joining us, an investigative journalist, contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and author of the best-selling book House of Bush, House of Sod. And I will be putting a 9/11 show on our show idea list, so hopefully we can explore this in further detail because there still are a lot of unanswered questions. So thanks again for joining us, Craig. And now I would like to welcome Josh Holland to the show. Josh is a contributor to The Nation and a fellow with The Nation Institute. He's also host of Politics and Reality Radio. And we are going to talk with Josh Holland about voter suppression in New York. Hey, Josh, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So we were watching the election in New York from here in California, shocked to learn that 126,000 registered Democrats were purged from the voting rolls in Brooklyn, and 3 million New Yorkers, which is about 27% of the electorate, were not able to vote because they were not registered with the Democratic or Republican parties. And I understand that you're an independent, Josh, so you were not able to vote in New York.
Yeah, it was very annoying. I actually wanted to vote for Zephyr Teachout, who's running for Congress in my district. And the Board of Elections here sent out a number of flyers last summer reminding everybody of the March 28th registration to a registration deadline. But they didn't mention the October 6th deadline to switch parties. And I'm not a member of a party, but apparently going from unaffiliated to Democrats is a party change. So I have to say that Teach Out only announced January 27th, so my candidate actually announced 4 months after the deadline. It's very, very frustrating. And I can see how people think it's a means of shooting down insurgent candidates. There's a long history, though, here, right? This is a law that goes back to the late 1800s. It was actually reformers pushed this particular provision in order to try to deprive party bosses of the ability to manipulate primaries, and now it's in the 21st century, it's actually a hindrance to popular participation. So there's a little bit of irony there.
Well, and it's also angering a lot of people. I mean, what did you hear from people in your neighborhood about what happened in New York?
Well, I mean, as you say, there's a lot of people who are very angry about it. The election administration in New York is historically pathetic, right? This is not, I think people need to understand that this is not a 2016 phenomenon. We have disastrously poor election administration every single time. And one of the things that I'd point out is that, you know, there's a reason, one of the reasons is that this is a very blue state, so it doesn't get the same kind of partisan attention. If you look at a swing state like Ohio, all eyes are on the Secretary of State, every move that they make. People, because they have partisan loyalties, are just watching really, really closely. In New York, we know how it's going to go in the general election, so we don't get a lot of attention on these things. And the election system is woefully underfunded. People vote on antiquated equipment. It's an incredible mess.
And what about what happened in Brooklyn? A couple of days ago, New York State's Attorney General opened an investigation into alleged improprieties and is also going to look into the New York City Board of Elections and why so many people were purged from voting. On Election Day, WNYC reported that 126,000 Democratic voters in Brooklyn were purged from the rolls. Do we know why that happened?
We don't know why that happened. We know that there are multiple investigations at this time. You know, there was the city suspended the top official in Brooklyn without pay. That's Diane Haslett Ruggiano. There's a lot of, you know, weird New York intrigue here, because the person who is primarily responsible for overseeing Brooklyn's Democratic voting rolls is a Democrat named Betty Ann Canizio. She's a deputy clerk. The Republicans are charging that the suspension of Haslett Ruggiano is kind of a scapegoating, you know, a matter of scapegoating the Republican. I don't know, and I don't think any of us knows. And the problem here, and we've seen this again and again, is that by the time we understand what happened, our attention is going to be elsewhere.
Right.
So, you know, we've seen this again and again going back forever. There was a piece in the New York Times about a major report in the mid-1980s about faulty election administration in New York. And, of course, that report was filed in some cabinet somewhere, and then nobody did anything about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are big structural problems here. It's not just New York. We devolve our election administration to the lowest and poorest level of government. We have not only antiquated equipment, but we have poorly trained poll workers. It is something that would be, you know, if you were to send international election monitors to an emerging democracy and see the kind of stuff that we see here, election after election after election, they would say, yes, these are not free and fair elections.
Right. We reported on this a couple weeks ago. There's a study out that found that the United States is the worst when it comes to voting systems among Western democracies. And Josh, I mean, you're in the epicenter of the 24/7 cable world. They are just covering this election nonstop. So why didn't they spend more attention on this, say, 2 weeks before the primary, given that New York usually doesn't matter like California doesn't, and so we don't get that much attention in June? But it seemed like one of them would have sent reporters out to ask a couple election officials, hey, are you ready for this? Because usually it doesn't matter.
I mean, that's a very good question. I don't really know what the answer is, except that what you say is true. In the larger sense, it doesn't have that partisan, you know, the partisan element that gets political reporters interested. It's a local bureaucratic issue, which is not exactly sexy and doesn't get eyeballs until 126,000 people in Brooklyn find that their registrations weren't valid, and then it becomes a matter of great controversy. And now everybody's rushing to cover it. And you know, part of it is probably that. You know, I don't have an answer, but I would imagine that part of it was that the polls showed Hillary Clinton leading by double digits. I think she was up by 15 points coming in or something like that, according to 538's polling average. So it also wasn't seen as a race that was going to come down to the wire. These are, you know, the editors have to make choices, obviously, allocate resources, and this is a place where a confluence of issues made this not a big story until it became a big story.
You also had affiliations switched. Some people had to go to a judge at the last minute to be able to vote. Polling stations were locked. Voting machines didn't work. People were asked. They were actually asked to write their candidate on a piece of paper. And then
yeah,
the poll worker said.
So I went down to my local voting station, and I, because there was a lawsuit challenging the law, there was a lawsuit challenging disenfranchisement in terms of these switched registrations, non-registrations on Long Island. And the attorneys asked as a remedy that the primary just be made into an open primary. And so they urged people like me, even though my registration was not switched, you know, by the Board of Elections, to just go vote and we'll see how it shakes out in court. And I went down to my local polling place and I felt pretty sorry for the bedraggled volunteers who were working there, because I came and I said, well, look, there's this court case on Long Island, and they just gave me blank stares. They had no idea what was going on. They could not get anyone on the phone from the county Board of Elections to ask them if they knew what was going on. So, again, this is indicative of this, like, just disastrous mess that our voting systems have become. And then you have these problems that are unintentional. You know, the lack of funding, all these things are not, nobody, they're not designed to screw people over. But then, at the same time, you do have secretaries of state and you know, Republican legislatures passing laws that they know are going to disenfranchise a certain type of voter. Those are very intentional efforts to disenfranchise people. So these things get caught up in a swirl where you start to think, well, you know, maybe this is intentional, when it's just a mess.
Joshua Holland is a contributor to The Nation and a fellow with The Nation Institute. He's also host of Politics and Reality Radio. Today we are talking about coverage of voter suppression and the voting mess that we have seen across the country. We did a show a couple weeks ago about Arizona in Maricopa County. It has the most people in Arizona live in Maricopa County, and yet they shut down so many polling places and people were in line well until midnight. So we want to let you know what to do in California to make sure this does not happen here. And we'd love to hear from you if you have any questions or comments about how these issues are being covered in the media. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. It's getting a lot of coverage for sure in the independent press. I was thinking that the night of the election, it would get a lot more attention on WNYC, for example, or the cable shows. What did you see? What stood out for you? How do you think the media should cover these voting irregularities and voting suppression in the United States? I mean, in addition to these ID laws, now you've got broken machines, polling places that just aren't opening on time. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So I called the Secretary of State's office in California, along with the San Francisco Department of Elections office, to make sure this information is right. So here's information on California. The primary is on June 7th, and you have to register or change your registration by May 23rd. If you're voting for a Democratic, Libertarian, or American Independent candidate in California's presidential primary, you can either register with those parties or choose no party preference. If you want to vote for the Green, Peace and Freedom, or Republican candidates, you have to register with those parties. You cannot choose no party preference. Now, to confuse things a little bit, if you live in San Francisco and you want to vote in the DCCC race, you have to be registered as a Democrat. So you cannot be no party preference or a Green and vote in the DCCC race. That's a lot of information, but we're going to put it on our Facebook page, and then we're also going to do some PSAs for KALW. And Josh, when I called the San Francisco Department of Elections official, the man who answered said, I don't think this is very confusing. But I do, and everybody I've told thinks it's very confusing. So what is the media's responsibility to get this information out to California voters?
Well, I think that they have a great responsibility. The LA Times had a piece yesterday or the day before about the incredibly confusing ballot.
Yeah.
They said, I think the quote was that it looked like it had been designed by chimpanzees. this is a mess. And it's interesting that the election official was like, this isn't confusing, because, of course, they're full-time dedicated to looking at these obscure provisions. When you say the DCCC, you're talking about congressional primaries, right?
It's our local, it's a race in San Francisco. Local people who are on the Democratic, I always forget the name, Congressional Campaign Committee.
So that's not members of, that's not a congressional.
No, it's the San Francisco Democratic Party.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee. That's what it's called.
I mean, why would it be? So those are Those are basically party rules. When you say that you have to
exactly.
register as a Green or a Republican if you want to vote Green or Republican, but you don't have to register as a Democrat or a Libertarian to vote for those candidates, those are party rules, right?
Those are party rules, right.
Right. Yeah.
And
I
so,
mean,
it is
incredibly confusing. I mean, look, the really fundamental issue is that the Constitution leaves it up to states to administer their elections. So, I mean, you know, most, when you talk about other developed democracies, wealthy countries, they have centrally administered elections. So you have the federal government on the federal level. Everything is standard. Everything is the same. If you're in one province or another province, you don't have these totally disconnected, you know, and confusing sets of rules. You don't have people designing their own ballots, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we devolve this to the lowest level of government, and that's why you get just this incredible patchwork of ridiculous rules and hanging chads and things like, you know, the New York BOE a few years ago, they sent out a ballot, a sample ballot, and they sent out instructions for an absentee ballot where they said, fill in the circle above the candidate that you want. But you actually had to vote. In order to vote, you had to fill out the circle below the candidate. So you have these things that are just ludicrous, and we deal with them. I don't know why we tolerate them. I think part of the reason is that we tend to have, and our media tends to have, rather short attention spans. So we pay attention to what becomes a big deal. So in 2000, Catherine Harris in Florida, she purged the voting rolls, and it became a big national story. And since then, people pay attention to purging voting rolls. But other problems don't become a big national scandal, and so we don't pay attention to them. And we only look at these things during the election season.
Right. Well, I want to make sure I don't confuse people. So again, the DCCC is the governing body of the local Democratic Party in San Francisco. It's comprised of local Democrats elected by voters in each assembly district. And if you want to vote in the DCCC, you have to be registered as a Democrat. You cannot be no party preference, for example. You cannot be Green. You've got to be a Democrat. Now, here's the other thing that makes it confusing, because let's say you're voting for a Republican president in California, but you live in San Francisco and want to vote in the DCCC race, you've got to choose either Republican or Democrat. You can't do both.
You can't do it.
Right.
Can't do it.
So we're going to repeat this throughout the next couple of weeks. You've got until May 23rd to register or change your registration. You can check the status of your registration online. And I suggest if you still vote in a polling place, print it out and bring it with you. And then to re-register, you can also do that online. You have to basically register again. So if you want to vote in the DCCC race in San Francisco, you've got to be a Dem. But if you want to vote for Republican, you cannot do both. Same applies with the Green Party. And if you have any questions about how the media covers these issues or doesn't cover these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Joshua Holland is a contributor with The Nation and a fellow with The Nation Institute. Let's hear from Marie Louise. Hi, Marie Louise. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes, I kind of would like to harp again about the importance of having voting day be a holiday when it comes to federal. I just feel like I hear too many people who simply cannot do it, and I think we could be that with it in the modern days, that we could make it a holiday. So I wanted to say that. Also, if I may just ask if anybody remembers, it seems to me that not in the very last election, but maybe the one before, a whole bunch of ballots were found in garbage cans. Hmm. And I'm thinking that maybe one of you or somebody else can remember the specifics of that. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you. I don't remember that one, but I do remember ballots in the Bay. Josh, did you hear about any of these?
You know, I've heard a lot of those stories, and I don't recall the specifics. But yeah, there's stuff like that is not unheard of again in our swampy elections. Now, let me make one point real quick. You know, we're in a primary process, and I think part of the reason why people aren't why maybe some in the media are hesitant to make a big deal out of this is that primaries are, you know, parties are private organizations. It's not a general election. You know, I've gotten a lot of pushback when I was complaining on social media from people saying, well, you could have just registered as a Democrat. These are primaries until 1972. You know, we've only been in this idea in this system where we have the idea that we have a democratic say in the party's nominees for 40 some odd years. Before that, it was decided in back rooms, you know, smoky back rooms by party bosses. So, you know, I think some political reporters definitely see this as a internal party process that they, you know, where the party decides, as is the title of that famous book, and that, you know, the expectation that it would be a fair democratic process is novel for them.
Mm. Well, you mentioned the LA Times piece, and they had a great report earlier this week, or I think it was last week, about 500,000 Californians are members of the American Independent Party, not realizing this is an ultra-conservative party. A lot of people chose the box because they think it's independent, but it's not. And a poll of American Independent Parties found that 73% of these 500,000 people mistakenly thought they were independent of all parties. Now, in order to be an independent in California, you have to choose no party preference. So if you are registered with the American Independent Party, you are not no party preference, and you will not be able to vote in the June 7th primary. You need to re-register. So again, there is a way for you to check your registration online, and we will put links to this. If you've got Facebook, we'll put it on the KLW Facebook, or we'll put it at yourcallradio.org to make things even more confusing. We have an email from Sandy who says, can political pressure be put on President Obama to sign an executive order which requires national elections to meet standards proportional to the population? Josh, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, you know, I don't know all of the constitutional law here. There have been lots of attempts to coordinate blocks of states so that they are effectively nationalized elections at the federal level, at the Electoral College. I'm not sure about the legality of this. We'd have to consult an elections lawyer for that one.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're going to continue covering elections throughout the next couple of months so we can bring that up. And Josh, just how do you think the media are covering independents? Because former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, who is a Bernie Sanders fan and supporter, he wrote on his Facebook page that the mainstream media are saying that the race is over. He says, so far, no article I've read about New York's primary mentions that independents were not allowed to vote. 42% of American voters are now independent, 29% Dem, 26% Republican. So this is very significant. And he says a lot of Bernie supporters across the nation are independent, and that deserves more media attention. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because I think that there's been a lot of confusion about independents. A lot of most independents are not swing voters. 60% vote reliably for one party or another. 20% don't vote at all. 20% vote reliably for one party, vote for one party but not reliably, so they'll skip elections. It's important not to confuse independents with swing voters. They are people who, by and large, are turned off by partisan rancor and don't want to identify with one party or the other. They tend to be less engaged with politics in general than members of the two parties. But it's a fallacy to say that they are, you know, just kind of moderates in the middle and can swing between the two parties. That's not true. The other point that I'd make is that there's been way, way too much emphasis on Bernie Sanders being the candidate of independents, whereas Hillary Clinton is the candidate of Democrats. It is clear that Sanders has attracted a greater share of independents, of Dem-leaning independents. But as of the latest data, we have data through the end of February's races, Sanders was leading Clinton 43-33 among independents. So it's not like, you know, all of these people who were unable to vote in New York primaries were de facto Sanders supporters. We would expect a very large share of them to be Clinton supporters as well.
And independents, when you poll independents, money in politics ranks really high. A concern about money in politics.
That's true. But again, you know, you have the polls all too rarely distinguish between Republican-leaning and Democratic-leaning independents. So when you have a polling result, you have to be mindful that that's going to be a mix of liberals and conservatives, and, you know, it's not going to tell us the difference between the two.
Mm. Well, I wanted to bring that up because we got an email about Democracy Spring, and this is not really getting much attention. It did get some attention last week after it was more than 1,200 people were arrested. A couple hundred people were arrested this week, including members of the Sierra Club, Ben and Jerry's, Greenpeace, the NAACP, and these are people in Washington, D.C., who are protesting about democracy, money in politics, and giving people the right to vote. Have you been following that at all, Josh?
I have been following it. It has gotten very little coverage. But, you know, I think that protest movements in general don't get a lot of coverage, and with some exceptions, right? Tea Party protests got a lot of coverage. The Occupy Wall Street protests got a lot of coverage. But there are a lot of protests that go on that just go sight unseen. I don't know why that is.
And why? What about? How does the nation cover these?
I believe we've covered it fairly well. This is something that was put together by actually former Occupy Wall Street people. I've heard about it going back to last September, October, when they were first organizing. And I think part of it is that it's just getting overlooked with the, you know, the 24-hour news cycle being so focused on the campaigns and Donald Trump sucking all the air out of our media coverage.
Right. And also another story that we were following, Doug Hughes is the postal carrier who flew a gyrocopter onto the grounds of the Capitol last year to protest big money in politics. Yeah. And he was just sentenced to 120 days in jail yesterday.
Isn't he running for Congress?
He is.
Yeah,
he hasn't gotten much attention, but I just found this, saw the headline, and just wanted to report on that because we talked about him last year when he did this.
I was really impressed with the fact that he didn't get hurt.
Right, and he landed pretty well. He had a nice, smooth landing.
Yeah. Well, I was afraid that he'd be shot down.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Josh, for joining us. Josh Holland is a contributor to The Nation and fellow with The Nation Institute. Thanks for joining us, Josh. Have a good weekend.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we're talking about the 18th annual Bay Area Dance Week, which runs until May 1st. Bay Area Dance Week is a vibrant celebration with over 400 free events, including classes, performances, and lectures. The Bay Area is a thriving place for dance companies. Dancers will join us to talk about the Bay Area Dance Week and the benefits of dancing. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.